The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome. Before we get started, I wanted to remind you that if you enjoy what we're doing over here and you want more stories that you get to vote on, you can head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We already have 36 bonus episodes over there, and there's so many insane stories to hear. We will also have a new poll up soon, so you can vote on our next bonus episode. Head over there, check it out, it's a good time. But our story today is mind-boggling. It is terrifying to know that there could be people in your life that have so much more evil in them than you really know. I know for myself, I like to think the best of people. You never want to assume that someone you're close to or love could be manipulating you for their own personal gain, because who wants to live like that? But it does happen, and that very tragically was the case for the Whitaker family. But let's just jump right in, because we have a lot to talk about. In 2003, Kent Whitaker was 54 years old, and his wife Patricia, or Trisha, was 51 years old. The pair lived in the Sugar Lakes neighborhood in Sugarland, which is a very affluent neighborhood in a suburb of Houston, Texas, and sounds delicious. And Sugarland is an upper-middle-class, white-collar place to live. It's very nice, everything is new, you hang out with your neighbors, you have a good time, and nothing really that bad happens there. Kent Whitaker initially met his wife Trisha on a blind date. He walked in her house and said he didn't know what he was expecting, but when she came down the stairs, he knew he had never had a blind date like this one before. The pair hit it off very well right from the start, and after only a couple of months, the two had fallen in love. They got married, and then came their two boys. The Whitakers were doing very well. Kent was a successful accountant, Trisha was an elementary school teacher, and she had a great rapport with children. Parents adored her, the staff adored her, she was just fun to be around. Barbie Harrington and Peggy McLean, Trisha's closest friends and co-workers, said her true love was being a mom. Her kids were everything to her. That's all she talked about. She loved her boys. Kent and Trisha had their two sons, 24-year-old Thomas Bartlett Whitaker, or Bart as we're going to refer to him, and his younger brother, 19-year-old Kevin. Bart, their eldest, did well in school and had a quirky sense of humor. Peggy McLean said he was fun, he was witty, he was respectful, and a good son. Bart also shared a passion for biking with his dad. Bart and his father spent hours and hours on training rides and organized rides, talking about everything. They were really close. And Kevin was more sensitive than Bart, but according to Kent, Kevin was a man at a very young age. He would not back down from injustice, but he was also quick to forgive, and he looked up to his older brother. From the outside looking in, they were the American dream. And money was no obstacle for their family. They gave their sons everything and more. To put it into perspective, they gave Bart a car, and he lived in a townhome while he was away at school. And they would give him a very nice college graduation gift, which we will get into. But everything shattered on December 10th, 2003. The night started out as a happy one. Bart was supposed to be graduating from college. He called his parents and said he had finished his finals and wanted to go out to eat and celebrate, since his graduation from Sam Houston State University would be that coming weekend. And Trisha was so proud of her son. She told Bart she was going to jump up and down and scream, "Thank you, Jesus." That night, they all celebrated, they laughed, they told jokes, teased each other, and took some pictures. Bart's parents also gave him his graduation gift, which was an expensive Rolex watch, which was something that Bart always wanted. Kent said it was just a very happy night. It had been amazing, and after finishing their dinner and dessert, of course, the family left the restaurant to go home around 8:20 p.m. When they pulled into the driveway, Kevin got out of the car first and walked up to the house, followed by his mother, Patricia. As Kevin unlocked the door, Bart went over to his Chevy Yukon, which had been parked on the street since he had left his phone in the car on accident. And Kent waited for Bart for a moment before walking up to the house. Kevin entered the house as he had done his whole life, but this time there was an intruder inside. That intruder was armed, dressed in black, and wearing a balaclava. Kevin was completely unprepared as he walked into the dining room and was shot in the chest. The bullet penetrated his heart, and his death was almost instant. He was still holding his car keys in his hand. Right behind him was his mother, who was also taken by surprise and shot in the chest as she walked through the door. Kent had made it to the porch and had heard the other two gunshots, so he entered his home and was also shot. The bullet entered the left side of his chest and lodged in his shoulder, missing his heart by only inches. As he lay on the ground next to his wife, who was bleeding out, he was in so much shock he almost believed the gunman was one of his son's friends with a paintball gun and was pranking them. It's such a heartbreaking situation and such a shock to go from celebrating with your family and having a lovely evening together and, you know, gifting your son a Rolex and taking pictures and eating dessert to then only 20 minutes later experiencing the most traumatic moment of your life. I don't even know how a person could begin to wrap their mind around that in the moment because it's just so completely out of the blue. And also, crimes like this don't happen where they live. So it's just so unexpected and didn't even feel real. Bart, who was the last to enter, ended up struggling with the intruder and got shot in the upper arm. And after that, the intruder fled the scene. One of their neighbors, Cliff Stanley, had heard the gunshots and came over to the house, and he went over to Trisha first, who was still alive and kind of moaning, and asked her what happened, and she said, "He shot us." She didn't specify who he was, she just said, "He shot us." Bart was lying on the living room floor, wounded, and as for Kevin, Cliff Stanley could see that Kevin was clearly already dead. He then saw Kent lying down, went up to him, and Kent told him, "I'm bleeding very badly." So Cliff used his t-shirt to stem the blood from Kent's bullet wound. And while that was going on, Bart called the police explaining that an intruder had just shot them. He fought with the gunman and chased him out the back door. And the police arrived at their home very quickly, because crimes like these were unheard of in this area, so they were very quick to respond. And when emergency services got on the scene, Kevin was immediately pronounced dead, but Patricia was still alive. So paramedics very quickly tended to her, and she was airlifted to the closest hospital, but later died of her gunshot wounds as well. Kent and Bart were also taken to the hospital. Kent had been critically injured and was unlikely to survive, but luckily, or unluckily, depending on how you're looking at it, he pulled through. That night, Detective Marshall Slott had just gotten home from church and got a call for a quadruple shooting, which he said doesn't happen out here in Sugarland. Marshall Slott was the lead detective assigned to the case. It looked as if it was a burglary gone wrong. The family was coming home from dinner, and it was plausible that they could have been surprised by a burglar. Very early on in the investigation, they found a leather glove on the pavement next to Bart's car, and they quickly found the murder weapon, which was left on the kitchen floor next to the back door. The killer had dropped it before fleeing the property. And what was interesting about that gun was that it actually belonged to Kevin. It had been a birthday gift from his older brother, Bart, to him, which meant the intruder had broken into the house and into the gun safe where the weapon was kept, and Kevin was then killed with his own gun. Which, of course, was very odd. Neither Bart nor Kent were able to give them many answers about the intruder, and what they did remember seemed to be conflicting. Bart said he believed the intruder was black, but Kent said he believed he had seen white skin around his eyes, but there wasn't much to see because he had been wearing all black, gloves, and a balaclava. But as Detective Slott combed through the Whitaker home, he realized things weren't adding up. A typical home invasion for a burglar is about getting whatever they can so that they can sell what they gather and make money. For many home invasions, the crime scenes look similar. The house is torn apart, the valuables are taken, that kind of thing. But in this case, things weren't exactly what the police were used to. Detective Marshall Slott said in the master bedroom, the dressers, and armoire all had drawers open on them, but they were all open an equal distance. It seemed very neat and orderly. And normally a burglar would throw everything out of the drawers to see if there's anything valuable in the drawers, but there was nothing out of place or on the floor, and nothing had been thrown. The only thing that was noticeably out of place was a pillowcase that had been found on the floor, but there were a bunch of expensive items that were still there and were even on display for the taking, but were completely untouched. There were electronics, laptops, jewelry, and none of those items, which would be typically taken in a burglary, was taken.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
The only thing that had been identified as taken was some cash from the wardrobe in the master bedroom, which was also strange because how would the burglar know where to look for this cash if they had never been in the home before? It almost seemed like the intruder knew exactly where to look for this cash. Detective Slott began to suspect that this burglary may have been staged. There was all of what I just mentioned, and there was also no sign of forced entry, almost like the back door had been left open. And then there was the murder weapon belonging to the Whitakers. The gun safe, which was in a built-out crawl space in Kevin's second floor bedroom, had been pried open. Detectives began to believe this person knew that this gun was here and obtained it for a very specific reason, killing the family. They also figured out that this person not only had to come unarmed and broken into this very concealed gun safe, but they had brought their own ammunition, so they knew exactly what ammo to bring. The magazine contained 6 rounds of core bond ammunition and 4 rounds that had been discharged with the same type of ammo. There had been ammunition in the house, but there was no core bond ammo. So that meant whoever had done this had prior knowledge. The police brought in 3 bloodhounds named James Bond, Quincy, and Columbo, which are incredible names, but each dog tracked from the back door where the killer had fled to Bart's vehicle, which was parked on the street in front of the house, which was where the leather glove had been found. Detective Slott started to wonder if Bart knew more about this attack than he was letting on. And by the next day, the grief around this double homicide turned into anger. Kent told Detective Slott in no unclear terms that he wanted them to catch whoever had done this. He was extremely upset and he was hurt, and Bart seemed to share that anger with his father. So Detective Slott continued his routine questioning of the survivors. Bart told Slott he was about to graduate from Sam Houston State University, but the next day they got some pretty shocking information. they discovered not only had Bart not graduated from his university, but he wasn't even enrolled there for quite some time. He was a freshman on academic probation, not a senior, although he had been there for 4 years. He had allegedly skipped a ton of classes and had gotten in trouble with a lot of his professors and was put on academic probation. At that point, instead of doing what he needed to do to get himself out of that situation, he ended up blowing his tuition money on whatever activities he wanted. The police then spoke to the university to see if that was in fact true, and they confirmed that it was. It was very shocking information. Bart just didn't seem like that type. He was from a well-off family. He was going to this university. He had been working as a supervisor in the food service department of the Bentwater Country Club. It just seemed like the more they learned about Bart, it just wasn't what you would expect of him. So bells and whistles started going off, and he's thinking, why is this kid lying to us? What does he have to hide? And when Detective Slott questioned Bart about why he had lied, he told them he just didn't want to disappoint his family. He needed a break, the stress of school had gotten to him, and he had told his mother about it, which is extremely convenient because Trisha was now dead, so investigators couldn't check up on that. But if you ask me, it definitely seems like she had not known because they had just gifted their son a Rolex, for Christ's sake, which are easily thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars, and could potentially be even more. I mean, I don't know how expensive of a Rolex they got him, but they can be real pricey. It just doesn't seem like the kind of gift you would give to your son who recently told you something extremely disappointing, you know? And when Kent found out about this, he was beyond mad. He wanted to know why his son had lied to them about being in school. How could he have done that? But Bart just gave him the same spiel about how he was overworked and he didn't want to disappoint him and blah, blah, blah. And then only 5 days after the shooting, another bombshell dropped. It was about 11 or 11:30 at night, and the sergeant on duty paged Detective Slott, saying, "Hey, there's somebody here who wants to talk to you." So Slott met this stranger in a darkened part of the parking lot behind the police station, and he explained that he had information that was crucial to this investigation. That man said that Bart Whitaker wanted him to help kill his family. That stranger Detective Slott had met in the police parking lot turned out to be an old friend of Bart's named Adam Hipp, and he told the detective an extraordinary story that Bart had approached him several years earlier with a detailed plan to kill his family. Adam even drew the detectives a diagram during their 3-hour-long conversation about this, and the plan called for Adam Hipp to be the shooter, shooting the family members as they came into the residence. The plan was for another acquaintance named Justin Peters, who was a former roommate, to supply the murder weapon. And then Bart would go out for a meal with his family, leave the back door unlocked so that the intruder could easily get into the house, and then the killer would wait in the dining room until the family returned. According to Adam Hipp, the plan even included a twist to fool the police. Bart wanted Hipp to shoot him in the shoulder so that he would look like a victim and not a suspect. It would be strange if only he didn't get shot, so he needed to get shot in the shoulder. Adam told them that Bart wanted to inherit his parents' share of the family construction business, and he wanted his family's estate, which was valued at about $1.5 million. So the police were already starting to suspect that something weird was up with Bart, but now Adam had just shown them the blueprint for this shooting. And for a moment, the investigators even believed that Adam may be the killer since he knew so much about it, but luckily for him, he had an airtight alibi for the night of the shooting. Police then tracked down Justin Peters, Bart's former roommate at Baylor University who was supposed to supply the murder weapon, and Justin also confirmed Adam's story. He said he even had the date the killings were going to be planned for, which was April 5th of 2001, but the plan had failed since details of the plan had been reported to the police by a college friend of Bart's, Jennifer Jaffet. The authorities had even alerted Bart's family at the time because it was a very serious accusation, but Kent and Trisha didn't believe them, and Bart claimed that this was all just a joke and some big misunderstanding, And why would they want to believe that their son was actually going to kill them? He hadn't given them any real reason to believe that or to fear him. So when the police approach them with this outlandish idea that their beloved son is planning a murder heist, they completely disregard it because it sounds so ludicrous. But that wasn't even all, because Justin Peters said that he had been recruited by Bart to kill his family before even that, with another student, Will Anthony. So originally, the plan was supposed to take place in December of 2000, but that plan had also been aborted since an alarm had been triggered at the Whitaker home after a window had been opened. Peters and Anthony actually made it to the Whitaker home as planned. But when Will Anthony went to open a back window, as soon as he touched it, an alarm went off and the two men fled. And this whole situation is terrifying enough to know that their son could be so evil and heartless to come up with a plan like this and then follow through with it one time. But now it's coming to light that he had three separate plans, two of which had just failed. So police obviously were focusing all of their attention on Bart. But surprisingly to them, Bart appeared to have nothing to hide. He agreed to help detectives by reenacting what happened the night of the shooting. But that interaction was really strange, and his behavior only heightened Slott's suspicions. Because, you know, he's reenacting what happened, but he's kind of like, oh, I don't remember. I probably would have run up this way, but I don't know if that's actually what happened. So he's like, yeah, I'll cooperate and I'll help you. But really, he's not giving them anything. So Slott is only getting more suspicious. 6 days after Trisha and Kevin Whitaker had been killed in their home, more than 1,000 friends and family gathered to celebrate their lives. A friend of Trisha's said almost every conversation with her included something about Kent, Bart, and Kevin. They were both loved so much. Kent and Bart were, of course, there. Everyone was so devastated, but also reminiscing about all the lovely parts of Kevin and Trisha. And Brittany Barnhill, who went to senior prom with Kevin, told Bart how much Kevin looked up to him. He was his hero. And honestly, that just breaks my heart and makes me sick at the exact same time, because it just shows you how little Bart actually cared about this whole situation, that he would kill not only his parents for money, but he would basically just kill his brother as like collateral damage and didn't care about his life because Kevin didn't need to be killed in order for Bart to get the money. And yet he was killed as well. I mean, maybe he would have had to split it with his brother and he didn't want to, but this just blows my mind that this was all like financial to him and he didn't have any care for what he was doing to the point where he planned it and tried to execute it three times, only then getting what he wanted in the third attempt, but not even really because his dad didn't end up dying. So it's just shocking and sad and scary, honestly. And amid the sadness that everyone was feeling that day, there was also a lot of anger. Friends and family wanted answers. But no one knew that among everyone who was mourning, the man the police were closely watching was Bart. The police did inform Kent that Bart was a suspect in the case, and Kent briefly considered it to be a possibility, but he never seriously believed that his son would do that. And Bart promised his father that he had nothing to do with it, that he loved his father, his mother, and his brother, and the idea of his son being responsible for this was inconceivable to him. But after Adam Hipp's story, Detective Slott felt otherwise. He began looking into Bart's history, and as it turned out, he wasn't the golden boy everyone perceived him as. He had a prior arrest record, he had broken into his high school and stolen computers, which was something he didn't need to do. His family had a lot of money and clearly had no problem with giving their sons more than what they needed. And after Bart was caught for that, his family transferred him to a different school, so he had very small consequences for that and was able to basically do whatever he wanted. According to the DSM-5, these are the criteria to diagnose someone with antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy. First, behavior that often conflicts with social norms, particularly not following laws and regulations, disregarding or violating the rights and feelings of others, difficulty feeling remorse or empathy, or justifying actions that have hurt others, a tendency to lie, manipulate, and deceive others, often for personal enjoyment or gain, general disregard for the safety of self and others, avoidance of responsibility, including work and financial commitments, aggressive and violent behavior, and constant irritability, and difficulty planning ahead or managing impulses. Symptoms of ASPD have been referred to as both psychopathy and sociopathy. There is no clinical difference between the two terms. Both concepts describe the ASPD experience, but psychopathy may be used more often to describe symptoms involving personality traits like low impulsivity and lack of remorse, while sociopathy may be used to describe behaviors that directly involve other people, like violence, criminality, and manipulation tactics. So I'm not a doctor, and I cannot diagnose Bart, but it seems like he had some kind of ASPD, because this list of the criteria for someone with ASPD seems to fit him like a glove. I mean, I only know what I know, but from what I've gathered, he has no problem breaking the laws and manipulating others to get what he wants, and he has no remorse and no regard for safety of others, and is violent. So it also seems like he's probably got a little bit of narcissism in there, because it doesn't seem like he thinks he's going to be caught. I think he believes that he is so much smarter than everyone else that he's executed the perfect crime and is just going to get exactly what he wanted. Meanwhile, the police have been onto him from like moment one looking into this case. But Detective Slott decided to check out two of Bart's closest friends, Chris Brashear and Stephen Champagne. He wanted to see if Bart had potentially approached his new friends to do the attack, considering he had approached his old friends to do the prior attacks that went wrong. Chris Brashear and Stephen Champagne worked with Bart at the Brentwater Country Club just months before the murders, and Chris Brashear had been living in Bart's townhouse in Willis, Texas at the time of the murders, and Stephen Champagne lived only a few doors down from them. Their initial interrogation happened in January of 2004, and both of them completely denied any involvement. Brashear said he had seen Bart on the day of the murders, but only to have lunch with him, and then he said he went back to his room and stayed there until about 10 p.m. He claimed he, Stephen, and Stephen's girlfriend had gone out to a bar that evening, so they had an alibi, which was conveniently each other. Slott had asked both of them to provide what police call scent samples, and using their bloodhounds, he compared those samples to evidence collected at the crime scene, and Slott's hunch paid off when he got a match. The dogs indicated that Chris Brashear's scent was on the drawers that had been moved that night, the leather glove they had found outside, the pillowcases in the master bedroom, the gun safe, and the murder weapon. Pretty damning evidence. So now they were the prime suspects.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
When Detective Slott grilled Brashear, he denied any involvement in the shootings. But when he told Brashear he had a definitive link between him and the murder weapon on the night of the shooting, horror and panic immediately washed over this kid's face because he knew they were closing in on him. Adam Hipp had agreed to help police in return for not being prosecuted for his role in the failed attempt years earlier. So he agreed to wear a wire and speak to Bart, hoping that he would incriminate himself in the killings. During that conversation, he referred to the 2001 plan and said that it was really similar to what had happened. He also said that he was worried because the police wanted to interview him and he was going to be taken into the station and he didn't know what to say. Bart told Adam to stop saying that it was our plan, because it wasn't, but Bart was obviously very spooked by what Adam was saying, and even offered Adam $20,000 to totally lie about the 2001 plan and say that it never happened. So they set up a mailbox for Bart to drop the payment into that would be monitored by police, and on April 1st, 2004, $240 in cash was delivered to the mailbox. The return address on the cash said it was from Kay Sorze, and the address was Bart's residence. And the name of Bart's favorite film character was Kaiser Sorze from The Unusual Suspects. So that told police that this was all a game to him, because that character supposedly outsmarts everyone, and it seemed like Bart thought that that was exactly what he was doing. He believed he was a mastermind in all of this, but he was not. They had even gotten his fingerprints on the envelope that he sent the money in. So he was doing a really shit job at being this criminal mastermind that he thought he was. Slot was definitely closing in on Bart Whitaker, and then one night, 7 months after the shootings, Bart told his father that he was heading out to a club. Bart told his dad that he would see him the next day, and that was the last time he saw him. He had just disappeared. So on June 28th, 2004, detectives find Bart's car, and it had been abandoned at an apartment complex in southwest Houston. Its engine was still running, but there was no sign of Bart, and he had stolen around $7,000 from his father. Detective Slott was furious because he felt like they had let him get away. And when Bart fled Sugarland, his father was in complete disbelief. Kent was beyond devastated. He couldn't believe that his son had actually done it and fled, because at this point, he didn't necessarily want to believe that his son was the one who had done it, but now he had fled, and in his mind, innocent people don't flee. I feel so bad for him. I cannot even imagine what he was going through at that time. It is so messed up. But for Detective Slott, Bart's disappearance was a setback, but still, they were going to be focusing on the suspects that were still in Sugarland, especially Stephen Champagne. They put wiretaps on Brashear and Champagne's phones, hoping that the three of them would be in contact and implicate each other, and they would be able to figure out where Bart had gone. But that didn't end up panning out, and they didn't even contact each other, so that went nowhere. But a major break in the case happened on August 28, 2005, more than 18 months after the killing. Stephen Champagne had finally cracked, and he contacted police saying that he needed to tell them everything. Police advised Champagne that he could potentially avoid prosecution as long as he told the truth, but he had to be honest. Champagne informed Detective Slott that he had participated in the crime and that Chris Brashear had killed the family. Champagne confessed that he was the getaway driver, Chris Brashear was the shooter, and that Bart was the mastermind behind the plan. He also told police that he didn't know the murder was going to occur, and he found out about it after the fact when he was helping Brashear get rid of the evidence. But when he took a lie detector test, he failed it massively. So since he had lied, his immunity from prosecution was now gone. Good going, Stephen. And he kind of felt like he had nothing left to lose at this point, so he agreed to a videotaped confession because they knew he did it, so he might as well give them the actual truth of the matter. He told them that he and Brashear had been recruited by Bart to kill his family. Brashear was the shooter and Champagne was the getaway driver, which was true, but he did know that the murders were going to happen. It didn't matter that he didn't pull the trigger, he had been complicit, which makes him equally responsible. After the shooting, he had driven them to the bridge over Lake Conroe, and they disposed of the items in a bag. That was when the floodgates of evidence opened. Champagne led Slott to a treasure trove of physical evidence. He led them directly to the place on the bridge over Lake Conroe where he and Chris Brashear had thrown the items of evidence. They found a chisel that Chris Brashear had used to break into the gun safe, ammunition that was used in the murder weapon, and two cell phones that Bart had provided them to use during the course of the attack. And this had been a plan for a long time. It turned out Bart had initially come to Brashear and Champagne about killing his family in the summer of 2003, and they thought that it was a joke at first, but it clearly was not. Champagne had apparently been very opposed to the idea in the beginning, but Bart told him that if he didn't help, he was already guilty of conspiracy because Bart had already told him what was going to potentially happen, and he hadn't done anything, so he was already guilty. Which wasn't true, because even if he did believe Bart was serious, he could have claimed he thought it was a joke. If he hadn't involved himself, he would have been fine. But I guess Champagne didn't know that, which was when he agreed to be the getaway driver. In September of 2005, Sugar Land Police arrested both Stephen Champagne and Chris Brashear for the murders of Trisha and Kevin Whitaker, but they still didn't know where to find Bart Whitaker. Bart had actually fled to Mexico. He ended up in a tiny village called Ceralvo, located about 40 miles from the Texas border. He could speak a little Spanish, and soon he had a small apartment in the town and a job at a local furniture store. He also had something else, a new identity. Bart was now Rudy Rios. He even had a girlfriend, Cindy Lou Salinas. Cindy Lou first saw Bart in church, of all places. She said, "I saw him and thought, wow, he's gorgeous." She found him very interesting. He had something nobody else she knew had. After Bart and Cindy Lou began dating, her father, Omero, gave Bart a job at the family's furniture store, and he apparently did great there. Cindy Lou's father loved him. He was a very good worker, and he said he held Bart in high esteem. Cindy Lou's brother, Ubaldo, befriended Bart and was impressed with his stories of adventure, like the one explaining his bullet wound. Bart told them he got the scar in the Afghanistan War. He said there was a surprise attack on his group by the Afghanis. Most of his group was killed. He shot at one of them with a rifle, but there was another one who got him in the shoulder. He created this whole impressive backstory so that everyone loved him, and it worked. The entire Salinas family took Bart in as one of their own, and Bart told them that they were the family he never had. He told Cindy he was an only child, and he was never loved by his mother, who was a prostitute. According to Bart, his family never gave him the love he wanted, they only gave him money, and they ignored him. Which was so far from the truth. His family loved him unconditionally, and gave him so much. I mean, I guess he did say they gave him money, but like, they definitely gave him love. He was not neglected. So for 14 months, he lived a carefree new life as Rudy Rios, with a girlfriend and a new family, and he was living large. But on September 14th, 2005, the police got a call from the real Rudy Rios. He called the police anonymously and said, "I know where Bart Whitaker is. I helped him get there." Rudy Rios and Bart had actually worked together at a Houston restaurant, and Bart explained to him that there was pressure on him from law enforcement. And Rudy said, "Well, if you ever need any help, let me know. I've got a family in Mexico that can help you out." According to Rudy Rios, Bart paid him $3,000 to escort him to Ceralvo, but when the word spread of a reward for Bart's capture, the real Rudy was looking to get paid again. And now he wanted the $10,000 reward money to turn Bart in. He said, "If there's a reward, you know, I don't care, I'll turn his ass in." And I just thought that quote was hysterical because, yeah, maybe he's a little bit of a shady character, but hey, he's looking out for number one. He's like, "Yeah, he paid me $3,000, I gave him my identity and drove him to Mexico, but now you're offering me $10,000, so I'll turn his ass in. I don't care." On September 22nd, 2005, after the FBI had been given all of this information, they worked with the Mexican officials to apprehend Bart and return him to Texas. Marshall Slott was there waiting when Mexican authorities dumped Bart back across the border. And that was the first time Kent had seen his son since learning the truth. He walked into the room and was separated from his son by bulletproof glass, but said, "Well, you look like you're okay." And Bart said, "Yes, I am. Dad, I'm just so sorry. I'm sorry for all of it. It's all my fault." Kent was still trying to hold out some hope that his son wasn't responsible, but with that statement, he knew it was all true. And I mean, he knew it was true deep down anyway, but it didn't make it any less devastating to hear it from his son's mouth.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
The prosecutor on the case was Fred Felkman, who was one of the toughest no-nonsense prosecutors in Texas. And because this was a multiple murder, prosecutors would be seeking the death penalty for Bart Whitaker. The defense planned to basically say that yes, Bart was guilty, but use the trial to convince jurors that Bart's life should be spared. And it definitely helped that his father was in his corner. Even knowing that his son had been guilty and responsible for his wife and son's murders, Kent couldn't understand why it was necessary to put his son to death. And incredibly, Kent Whitaker had forgiven Bart. Kent said, "The first night in the hospital, I forgave everyone who was involved in this. It is a gift of God that allows me to do this. I think he gave me the gift so that when I found out it was my son, that it would be a legitimate forgiveness." Which I think is incredible. I don't even know how you begin to forgive the person responsible for this, especially after finding out that it was such a premeditated attack by someone who's supposed to love you. But I am not a parent, and also, I think it was a very religious thing for Kent, so if that gave him some kind of peace, then I guess that's a positive in some way. Like, he had been through enough, so if this is good for him, then so be it. Sugarland, Texas had never seen a trial like this. A case of multiple murders where the accused was being passionately defended by one of the people he tried to kill. Kent felt like if the state pursued the death penalty and received it, they would then kill the last surviving member of his family. And he said, "I believe as a Christian that God can and does forgive and change people's hearts. If they are sorry, if they repent, if they ask his forgiveness for real, he will forgive them." But Jeff Strange and Fred Felkman said their duty was to uphold Texas law, not God's law. Prosecutor Jeff Strange said Kent Whitaker's religious faith is genuine. Forgiveness is a big tenet of what he believes, and I respect that, and I totally understand that. That's not my job, though. According to Fred Felkman, Bart definitely met the criteria for the death penalty in Texas. He was a continued threat, he intentionally caused the death of two people, and there was no reason for it. He wasn't abused or surrounded by crime, he was not even remorseful. Even if he said he was, he clearly wasn't, based off of his prior actions. So during preparations for the trial, the DA received a Christmas card from Bart, and in this Christmas card, Bart stated that he should keep his family in mind during the holiday season, which definitely feels like a threat. It's kind of like Bart saying to his prosecutors, "Keep an eye on your family. I just killed my own and I might kill yours," which obviously he didn't say all that, but like, how else are you supposed to read that as a prosecutor who's like working very hard to not only put you away forever, but give you the death penalty? So it definitely felt ominous. Stephen Champagne had already assisted the state in its prosecution of Bart and Brashear and was getting a plea deal to lesser murder charges, receiving 15 years in prison. And Brashear didn't get the death penalty because they determined that if Bart hadn't influenced him, he wouldn't have carried out these crimes. So after pleading guilty, he got 30 years. And considering what he did is really not all that bad. Bart's father had hired his son an attorney and was really trying to keep him from getting the death penalty. Meanwhile, Bart was complaining that he hadn't gotten a plea deal and he wanted the big guns as his attorneys. So he was just doing a lot of whining. Like, he doesn't deserve a plea deal, one. And two, the fact that he's getting any attorney from his father is astounding to me, but the fact that he's now complaining about his attorneys not being the big guns is unbelievable to me. Shut up. The fact that you have any support from your father is incredible. So take it and be happy. But I mean, he's not like a normal person, so why would he be happy? He's just going to continue to take and take as much as he can because that's all he cares about. So 3 years after Trisha and Kevin's murders, Bart Whitaker's trial was finally underway. Prosecutors presented crime scene analysis, forensic evidence, and eyewitness accounts, but everyone was waiting to hear from Stephen Champagne. During his testimony, he was able to give the intricate detail of the plans and the attack. He said that 2 months before the shootings, Bart offered both him and Chris Brashear a cut of the $1 million insurance policy to help kill the Whitaker family. On the day of the killings, they had changed the license plate on Champagne's car. Champagne stayed outside the restaurant waiting until the family left, and when they left, he followed behind them and parked on the street behind the house just as he had been instructed to do by Bart. He received a call from Brashear, who was in the home, and had noticed that he had lost a glove. After the shootings, Brashear ran to Champagne's car and got in with a large white envelope of money, since Bart had told him exactly where to find this money in his parents' bedroom. As they drove away, Brashear told him that he had shot all of them and detailed that before shooting Kevin, he had walked in and saw the gun pointed at him and Kevin smiled, potentially thinking that this was a joke or it was potentially a nervous reaction, but he smiled before he was shot in the chest and died. And then Brashear carried out the staged struggle with Bart for the gun before fleeing. He shot Bart in the arm as he was told and left out the back door. They then changed the license plate back, dumped the evidence and their clothes, and they went out drinking after with the money that they had taken from Bart's parents' bedroom. How heartless can you be? And I want to be surprised about that, but honestly, I'm not. What's surprising to me is that Bart was able to convince so many people in his life to help him commit the murders of his entire family. Because he had 3 failed attempts, and throughout those 3 failed attempts, he had, I think, 5 different people, potentially 6, if I'm misremembering. He must have been very good at manipulation, but also these were clearly people who were not very good to begin with, because even if you have the best manipulator, like, I'm still not gonna go kill someone's family. So yeah, I don't know. It's just like, oh my God, they just killed this person's family, and now they're taking the money that they took and they're going drinking afterward. Like, it was just a completely normal night. Unreal. And here's the craziest part. So a few months after the killings, Champagne, Brashear, and Bart met up in February of 2004 because Bart wanted to question Champagne about what he was going to do with the police, and that wasn't all he wanted. He told them that the job was not finished. He very calmly started discussing with them how they were going to kill his father and finish the job. His father needed to be killed if they wanted the money. So that's all this was to him, money. It didn't matter that these were his parents and his brother, who all loved him so much, and that the police were breathing down his neck at this point and had already found Stephen Champagne and Chris Brashear. He wanted them to finish the job. And I truly cannot imagine how Kent was feeling after hearing that evidence. He had been supporting his son this whole time and would continue to do so. So in my mind, there has to be some sort of denial happening, or I don't know, some divine intervention in his mind. I really don't know. But It's incredible to me that he could forgive his son in the first place, let alone after hearing that he was trying to finish the job, aka form a plan to kill his father for the fourth time. Later in the trial, it came out that the 2003 attack wasn't the first time Bart had tried to kill his family. Like we talked about, he had made three other attempts using his other friends as recruits, and all of them were put on the stand, so this all came out in court. Bart was described as highly manipulative and had a real ability to control people, which is what psychopaths can do, exploit very vulnerable people without having any real feelings about it. Bart Whitaker's trial lasted 6 days. The jury deliberated for only 2 hours, returning with a verdict that everyone was expecting, guilty on 2 counts of capital murder. And despite everything that came out in trial, Kent begged the prosecution and the jury not to give his son the death penalty. Bart also decided to speak directly to the jury on his own behalf. He said he was 100% guilty for the crimes, and that he felt remorseful. He even cried on the stand. Defense attorney Randy McDonald asked him why he did it. Bart said, "I have come up with a lot of reasons for how I got to where I was going, but they do not explain it. I always felt like whatever love they sent me was conditional, on a standard that I never felt I could reach. And somehow, to me, that doesn't justify it." Boo-hoo, Bart. Your family wanted you to do well in school, and for that reason, you murdered them in cold blood? I don't think so. I think you wanted their money, and you have no feelings. And prosecutor Fred Felkman agreed with me, saying it was all crap. There was no evidence whatsoever that his family ever did anything to him, and they loved him unconditionally. He said he believed Bart was not actually sorry, and he was just sorry he got caught and was now just trying to figure out how to get out of the death penalty. It took jurors only 10 hours to reach a verdict, and they did determine that he would be sentenced to death. Kent was devastated. Over the next decade, Kent Whitaker lobbied the state tirelessly for his son's death sentence to be commuted to life. But when Bart's appeals were exhausted, his execution was scheduled for February 22, 2018 at 6 p.m. The week before his son was to be put to death, Kent made one desperate plea for mercy to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. He said, "We're not asking him to forgive him or let him go. We just want him to live. Bart was the last surviving member of my natural family, and no one in my family wants to see him executed." Just 2 days before the sentence was to be carried out, the board made what could have been a life-saving recommendation for clemency, but the final decision had to come from the governor, and when execution day arrived, there was still no word for him, so Kent went to see his son for the last time. They touched hands through the glass and said their goodbyes. Bart ate his last meal and was ready to be strapped to the gurney and killed by lethal injection. With less than 40 minutes until 6 p.m. and Bart Whitaker's life was to be taken by lethal injection, Governor Abbott spared his life. Kent said they were standing together and praying when his phone rang, and so he said that we had a commutation. At that point, I put it on speaker and let everyone hear, and the whole room erupted. Bart said he was grateful for the decision, not for himself, but for his dad. And he's still serving life in prison to this day. That is such a crazy detail to me that 40 minutes before he was supposed to be killed, he was spared. They really went down to the wire with that one. And also, I'm pretty sure the governor had like 30 other cases that he was asked to pardon or give a commutation to, whatever the correct term is, but he denied all of them. I'm pretty sure Bart was like the only one he had accepted up until that point, and I don't know into the future if he accepted any more, because this wasn't too long ago. Like, this happened in 2018, I believe. So it was kind of unheard of that he had done this, and again, it happened 40 minutes to go. And Kent was very happy, so I guess I'm happy for Kent, and honestly, Kent alone, because he's been through enough, but... Anyway, Kent today is married to a woman named Tanya, and they're living their lives together. And what Kent went through is unimaginable, so I can't even begin to put myself in his shoes. But it's more than any person should have to go through in a lifetime, so I just hope he's happy and he has a good life. But this story is a terrifying reminder that there are evil people out there that just don't seem like it. And I did look it up because I was curious. About 1% of the general population have clinically significant psychopathic traits, which at least in the US is over 3 million people, which is a significant amount. And it's very weird to think of it like that. But also, not everyone who is a psychopath is dangerous. So that's good to keep in mind. They're just more likely to be dangerous. I don't know if that helps. I just thought it was an interesting point. And that is kind of all I have to say about this story. I mean, my heart breaks for the Whitaker family. Because having multiple people in a family be killed in such a traumatic way is already so traumatic. But then to have the person responsible be another part of the family is just awful. So I hope that there's a lot of healing and happiness and health that happen for the Whitaker family, because that's quite enough for them, you know? But anyway, why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser and I'll tell you something good, that way we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing is that we're already mostly through February. And after February comes March, and then after March comes April and May, and then it's summer, June, right? That's how I'm looking at it right now, because it is so snowy outside and so cold, and I am ready for summer, as I'm sure so many of us are. Hello, Midwest. Sorry this sucks, right? Oh my God. February is just a dreary month, and even though it's the shortest, it kind of feels like forever. So I'm just glad that we're almost through it, you know? I think that's something to celebrate right now. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to check out those bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. If you have a story of survival that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast. But the T on the end of podcast is a 3, because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.